talk today is by order of Melnick on the rather intriguing connection between pi oscillations and phase transitions or transformations.
Thank you, Arya. Actually, this is just one dynamic slide. All other slides are static. I'm going to talk about phase transformations, and indeed, I believe it is an important topic within this program on high oscillations. What you see here on this slide is essentially solid-solid phase transitions, and essentially what is represented here is essentially two phases. This phase is so-called parent phase, which is called austenite, and here on both sides you actually see martensitic phase. And if you zoom this, essentially within this area, you would see something like that. If you zoom further, which actually you have to do, at certain point when you construct mathematical model, you would look at atomistic scale. And what is represented here is essentially just these solid-solid phase transitions in the dynamic setting. So let me put this sort of down and take my talk. This is the actual title of my talk, so that was sort of a very brief introduction. Time-dependent model for phase transformations, and mainly I'm going to concentrate on numerical approximations of the model that I'm going to discuss. This is the list of collaborators that I have on this topic. Outline of my talk. So basically, I do not assume that everyone has background in phase transformations and mathematical models for phase transformations. So I'll give introduction related to that. I'll give classifications of phase transformations, and I will highlight mathematical tools for the analysis of these phase transformations. Basically, mainly I will be focusing on the so-called first-order phase transformations, and most of my exemplifications will be given for the first-order phase transformation, specifically for the material with memory. Then I would move. I will show you how to prove conservation law for the differential model, and what I actually would like to aim at, I would like to aim at preserving these conservative properties on the grid. Both of these results that I'm going to talk about here are related essentially to one-dimensional models. However, I would like also to generalize this technique to the three-dimensional case. So I will show you how to reduce, using center manifold technique, three-dimensional, very complicated model to low-dimensional models, and basically where the theory that I'm going to talk about here would apply. And then I will conclude. A brief history here. So many of us as mathematicians sort of we usually look back at Stefan problem, which is free boundary value problem, and around this time he published basically four papers where he studied the solidification essentially problem, essentially the formation of ice in the polar seas. The work on phase transformation, so goes before that, because Gibbs around this time actually wrote a paper on the equilibrium of heterogeneous substances. And many of us who are interested in multi-scale modeling, basically, if you like, this is one of the first papers related directly to this area. Ernst Ising in 25 constructed one-dimensional models for ordering spins. His generalization for multi-dimensional case was wrong, but it was very influential work. And of course, after that sort of work on irreversible thermodynamics, for which sort of two people got Nobel Prizes. What I'm going to talk about today basically originated from work of Landau back to 37, and also work of Lipschitz 41, which essentially was the origin of the creation of the theory of critical phenomena and phase transitions. So basically, these people addressed two major issues: how to describe order in terms of irreducible representation of the symmetry group, and the second question basically that they address, how to introduce the notion of spontaneous symmetry violation and how to cure essentially this problem using the order parameter as the measure of this violation. And of course the sort of the history is very interesting, but I'm not going to drag upon that, and of course very important contribution by Fisher, Wilson, and many other people. So for the purpose of my talk, I essentially So to put equality sign between phase transformations and change in state. So when we are talking about state, about the phase, we are talking about a part of a body that has the same state. And this sort of definition goes back to Gibbs. So the state is characterized by a set of state variables. And if you are at macroscopic levels, you use macroscopic variables. But if you go sort of further down the scale, you could also use atomistic arrangements here, or even electronic states. I'm not going to talk about electronic states, although we sort of working in this area as well. Phase transformation here, or phase transition, is the transformation of a system from one phase to another. So basically, we are talking about two different states of the system, which are in different phases, if we have an abrupt change in their properties while transforming from one state to the other. And essentially, this key word here, abrupt change, was used originally to classify phase transformations. So pretty sort of natural mathematical classification was proposed back to 33 by Ehrenfest, who essentially proposed to classify phase transformations on the basis on the degree of non-analyticity involved, and mainly in the context of discontinuity in the corresponding derivatives of the free energy function. This classification, though, appeared to be not exactly precise, and what we're using now, again, something that comes from work of Gibbs. We are talking about first-order phase transformations, essentially in the case when we have to deal with mixed phase regimes, where some part of the system have completed the transition and the other are not. And the examples basically all sort of classical, even domestic sort of household examples, but as well as with Einstein condensation belongs to phase-order phase transitions. Second-order phase transitions sort of mathematically easier to analyze, and the reason being because they are continuous phase transitions. But examples are, of course, sort of very fruitful, and there are many useful and important examples. And critical phenomena are phenomena associated essentially with the second order phase transitions. And of course, there are infinite order phase transitions, which sort of, again, I'm not going to talk about. So my sort of concentration today is essentially on the first order phase transitions, where we have to deal with mixed phase regimes. When you're dealing with situations like that, you have, in most situations, you have also to deal with hysteresis effects. Here, sort of, it's represented as a simple relay type relationships where sort of all points between A and B on this interval are unstable equilibria. Sources of hysteresis effects are, of course, wide. It's nonlinear dynamics. If you have constitutive relationships or scale interactions of both, then in many cases also you have to deal with hysteresis effects and, of course, non-convex potentials. So when I'm dealing with hysteresis, I'm dealing essentially with memory effects. So somehow in mathematical models, I have to incorporate these memory effects. And memory effects here are incorporated in such model at the macroscopic scales, but it is a result of effects that are pronounced at smaller scale, at micro scales. And another important thing that I would like to emphasize, that phase transitions take place between phases with different symmetry. So essentially, somehow you have to deal also with this broken symmetry situation. When symmetry is broken under the phase transition, we need to introduce one or more extra variables to describe the state of the system. And essentially, that's exactly what we do when we introduce so-called the order parameter due to Landau, which essentially describes the character and strengths of the broken symmetry. So, implications of phase transitions, there are many, but for us, for mathematicians, important point to realize that essentially one of the most important implications is the formation of topological defects that we somehow have to deal with. And the way to deal with, as I already said, is essentially on the basis of the order parameter. And this order parameter may take different values in different parts of the system due to various physical effects, for example, thermal fluctuations. So the basic idea behind the Landau theory is essentially that the system described using the Helmholtz free energy function F. And what you do with this function F, you essentially expand it in even degrees, and in some cases, essentially, we need also correction using Ginzburg term. For specific phase transformations that I'm going to describe, essentially the fourth order expansion is not sufficient, but I'm going to talk about later on. So the idea here is sort of very simple. Now, a little bit about mathematical tools that are applied to deal with this phenomena, with hysteresis effects. First of all, until 1970, there was no systematic analysis of hysteresis effects. And let's start from this sort of simple parabolic type equation. For this type of equations, the concept of hysteresis operators was introduced by Krasnoselsky. And the model like this, for the parabolic type of operator, where omega here is essentially this hysteresis type operator, where you could use the standard stop and play operator, or more complicated, say, Prandtl-Wieslinski operator, have been studied in the literature by a number of people. Some of them are listed here. The typical assumptions, if you'd like to show the existence for this type of model with hysteresis, are essentially listed here. They are sort of reasonably straightforward. This is essentially typical regularity assumptions on the solution and on the parameter that is introduced based on your hysteresis operator. The situation, however, becomes much more complicated when you move to hyperbolic case. And of course, we've heard here many talks related to the wave equation, where essentially sigma as a function as du dx is just a linear function. But in many situations, it's not the case. And of course, we know that in the general nonlinear case, this equation for sigma as a nonlinear function of strain, because du dx is essentially strain in one-dimensional case, does not possess global smooth solutions, no matter how smooth the initial data. And this result is sort of quite well known. Slemrod essentially reiterated this result in very nice way, which is directly relevant to my talk, because what he said, we need to introduce some sort of dissipation. And this sort of dissipation essentially could be introduced using the heat type of equation. So essentially what I'm going to talk about here when I'm talking about phase transformations, about the models which are based on sort of hyperbolic type equation, which in some way would be coupled together these parabolic type equations. And one of the, although this idea sort of has been around for quite some time, but it was very nicely sort of formulated also by Slemrod. If you would like sort of to analyze just this hyperbolic model, of course you will hit a number of problems, one of which sort of highlighted here. Say, for example, if you move along what, for example, Qureshi is proposing, assume the strict convexity of a hysteresis loop, then essentially the problem of existence would be reduced to the inequality between input function V and the output function W, which is related to your hysteresis sort of operator in this way. And basically what you need here, you need the passage to the limit in the hysteresis equation. And of course, for phase transformations, it is a problem because we are lacking the continuity in the C space. So how I'm going to deal with the problems. First of all, as I mentioned at the beginning, as you've seen also on my first slide, that I'm basically going to exemplify the situation on the so-called solid-solid phase transformations. Specifically, I'm going to talk about shape memory type of effects. And in this type of transformations, essentially, we have to deal with two different phases. And these two different phases are pronounced at the crystallic lattice level. One phase is called martensite. And the other phase is called austenite. Austenite is usually a high temperature phase, and martensite is low temperature phase. And essentially, you have to deal with two different equilibrium configurations of the system related to these specific phases. What we would like to do here, we would like to develop an adequate mathematical description and a systematic approach to solving problems with this first order solid-solid phase transformations. The particular points that I, sort of before moving to the model, I also would like to mention here that for this specific example that I'm going to consider first order solid-solid phase transformations, the materials that I'm dealing with undergo a change in their crystalline form as they are cooled or heated through the characteristic transformation temperature. The other point is that during the transformation, essentially alternate bands are formed, known as twins, and usually it's twin martensites, such that essentially we still have balance, that these twins balance each other, so there is no overall shape change, and that's the reason why these materials are called shape memory materials. And the last point that I would like to make is that transformation, of course, happens because either of these two phases are thermodynamically more stable. But again, heating the material or cooling the material may switch it to go to another phase. Now, this is sort of helps for those of you who sort of are not completely familiar with this topic. I would like to represent you, sort of to give you three brief interpretations of the phenomena that I'm going to describe. First, at macroscopic level, then microscopic level, and then I sort of give you simple mechanical interpretation of that. So at the macroscopic level, assume that you are dealing with a rod, which made of these type of materials. And first, you are dealing with cool temperature phase, which is martensite. Then you could deform this rod as much as you like. And of course, the shape will be a little different. But what happened then when you heat this material, the rod will pop up into its original configuration. So depending on the temperature, you will have different shapes, but the ability of this material to go back to the original configuration due to this existence of two different phases at the crystallic level, that's essentially how we could interpret that at the microscopic level. At microscopic level, when you go to sort of to the level of crystallic lattice, high temperature phase, which is austenite, is more regular phase. And which, if you cool the material, you will go to twin martensite. And remember when I said that there are twin martensites, one essentially twin martensites, so they balance each other. There is no overall change in shape. And under certain deformation, again, you will go to the stable deformed martensite. And only under the heating, you could sort of go back to austenite. Now, one more thing is that we've seen here. Oh, sorry.
Question. If the rod is straight and you heat it up, it's going to. The shape is changed.
Yeah.
Is it a rod?
No. When you have a rod, when you have straight rod, right? What you do, you could deform this rod as much topologically as much as you want.
It's still a rod.
Yeah, it is still a rod, but I mean, it's different shape rod. Okay, you change the shape of this rod as much as you want. So what happened then? You just heat this material, and this curved rod will pops up back into its straight form original configuration. So that's the story. Now, you've heard here already a number of different interpretations, especially related to Hamiltonian dynamics, sort of spring type of systems, for example, related to harmonic oscillators and many other things. Here the situation is different. You sort of could give also the interpretation like that here. But you know what you usually seen before. You've seen usually before sort of Hooke's law type relationship between force and displacements for the string. For the situation I'm talking about, it's more complicated than that because essentially under low temperature the material behaves completely differently compared to the high temperature situation. And essentially, mathematically, again, this type of behavior could describe using this hysteresis loop that I was mentioning before. So how to do that? Starting point, the Landau-Ginzburg-Devonshire model for the free energy function. And essentially what it tells you that any isothermal equilibrium configuration of the lattice corresponds to a minimum, either local or global, of that function. So, and as I already emphasized several times, we here have to deal with two different configurations, namely what is called austenite and martensite. Actually, this is two real people. I mean, as you know, Martens, Adolf Martens, was and British guy, Roberts Austen, who was here, I believe, even. So we have to deal with these two different equilibrium configurations simultaneously. How do we do that? Free energy function here is represented as a sum of three main terms. One term is related to sort of thermal energy of the system. One term is related to elastic energy of the system. Epsilon here is just the strain, so which is the derivative of the du with respect to dx. And this term represents the coupling between mechanical and thermal part. Essentially, in the end of the day, we take this function as the polynomial, we approximate it as the polynomial, and this important generalization of the Landau theory was made by Fock, so-called Fock extension. And original Landau theory, as many of you know, is essentially takes the polynomial up to the degree of order 4. Fock extended there to the degree 6, and as you would see on the next picture, the reason why. The reason why, because we have to deal with all these possible situations. So what is plotted here is essentially free energy function as a function of strain, or in other words, du dx. So for the low temperature situation, you have two well-pronounced minima here. And this minima corresponds to this twin Martin side, as I mentioned before. This maximum here corresponds to austenitic phase. So what happened then, if you sort of increase the temperature, free energy is changing, and you essentially have to deal with this triple well situation. If you continue heat, then your high temperature phase will prevail. And eventually the material will go essentially to elastic type of behavior. And what we have to do, of course, a number of researches done sort of separately of these different cases. Of course, this is the most classical elastic case. Willis, for example, from Cambridge, analyzed the situation of triple well potential. But we have to cover all these situations if we would like to deal with phase transformations here for this type of materials. Now, how does it look like for the stress-strain situation? For stress-strain situation, if you introduce your free energy function using these six-order polynomials, as I mentioned before, you essentially would cover the following situation. So the low temperature phase looks like this. And what it does for you, this mathematical sort of, if you like, idealization in some way, this situation mimic for you the hysteresis loop. And this is lower temperature phase. Now, again, if you increase the temperature, eventually you would go to this type of curve. And this type of curve, you know, as you see, pretty close sort of to linear dependency, which is sort of within the classical elastic situation. But again, it covers all possible sort of situation that we have to deal with. So the model for phase transformations here in the one-dimensional case looks like that. So what you see here, essentially a wave equation in a sense, but where you see stress here is substituted by this quintic type of nonlinearity. Why quintic type of nonlinearity? I mentioned to you that the free energy function in six-order polynomials, but free energy function differentiated with respect to strain gives you this fifth-order polynomial. And this equation is essentially, so basically u here is the displacement, theta here is the temperature. So this hyperbolic type of equation, nonlinear quintic, this quintic nonlinearity hyperbolic type equation is coupled to the sort of parabolic type equation using sort of this term.
What's V in the last equation?
V is the velocity, so this is just du dt. Yes. Thanks. Yeah.
So when the temperature is higher, the k2 and k3 terms are being knocked out.
When temperature is high, basically everything depends on the coefficients. Also that you have, because for different materials, essentially this K1, K2, K3, you would have different situations. But you would have all...
It becomes elastic, normally.
That's right. But you would have all those terms still, but it will have, you will have weak nonlinearity, essentially, which the situation well analyzed in the case of weak nonlinearity. Anything else? And here, sort of briefly, sort of this is initial mechanical conditions. Only the reason why I sort of written down then, because usually boundary conditions you have to impose for stress, and if you have to impose for stress, it's additional complication, because remember, your stress is also a nonlinear function of strain. Now, as you've seen, the stress-strain dependency here is non-monotone function. So how are you going to deal with this situation? How are you going to solve the problem? The idea was that we proposed in this context was very simple. Essentially, what we did, we treated this stress-strain dependency as a purely algebraic relationship. So instead of sort of solving these PDEs that you see, we just introduce this sort of relationship, stress as a function of strain, as a separate algebraic relationship. So what you could do after that, of course, and you introduce additional variables, just strain explicitly, velocity, and the temperature as differential variables, and S for stress strain dependency as algebraic relationship. And so what you have as a result, you have essentially this type of system. And you know how to basically solve it. What you could do in a very straightforward manner, you could just use the method of lines, discretizing your spatial variables here everywhere, which is not difficult to do. And essentially, you will have a big system of differential algebraic equations, which we solved, and we could get quite reasonable results. But we were not completely satisfied, and the reason being because you have to have very high resolutions, as you realize, of course, for the problems like that. So, and that's the reason why we started looking at some conservation, at some invariant properties of the differential models, and hopefully how to preserve those invariant properties for their numerical approximation. And of course, conservative scheme sort of goes back to Courant's time and back to energy methodology. For nonlinear problems, it's sort of more recent results by Abrashian and more recently by Furuhata and a number of other. And there are a number of quite interesting results also related even to Hahn-Hilbert equation describing a phase separation phenomenon. So what I'm going to use here, modified integral interpolational methodology, where in addition to the interpolation of the solution with respect to independent variables, my variables will be the same as I described to you after introducing this algebraic equation, where additionally we also perform the Cyclov averaging of the nonlinear terms. So in terms of conservation law for the differential case, you could show that in the case of absence of distributed loading, so in other words, when your right-hand side parts are essentially zeros, you have the total energy conservation, where the full energy here is introduced in this way, where hopefully you still remember that epsilon is a strain, which is just the derivative du dx, with all this scalar product taken in space L2. So this is conservation law, which we would like to preserve now on numerically on the grid.
Okay, but this is a formalist.
This is for original differential problem.
Assuming you have a smooth solutions, then you have this conservation law.
Say it again.
So provided solutions are smooth enough.
Right.
This is whole.
When there are no right hand side part, as you see.
Right, but no singularities on solutions.
Right. Well, first of all, this is formal. This is absolutely formal. But the point here also is when you're talking about singularity, you may remember my sort of original pictures, but you remember what we essentially did. We introduced these stress-strain relationships based on polynomial dependencies. So as such, there is no singularity already in the model. And this is the way how essentially we treat it. Now, this is essentially the discretization that we used, and this is essentially strain temperature and stress itself are taken for integer grid point and velocity itself for the flux point. And this nonlinear term where you have sort of fourth and sixth order nonlinearities are just averaged out in the Cyclov sense. And then, the next slide is a little bit sort of probably overcomplicated, but I'll explain that briefly. You still sort of, it's pretty straightforward discretization, and I put here also just to help it out. First of all, you know, this upper indices is related to time, right? Lower indices are related to space. And also, if you see sigma 1, sigma 2, or sigma 3, they are related just distributing your discretization between two time layers, as it is highlighted here. So what we did, we introduced three parameters. Three parameters with respect to all three differential equations that you have to deal with respect to the velocity, the parameter here in the scheme sigma 1, with respect to the strain, the parameter sigma 2, and with respect to the temperature, the parameter sigma 3. So we have three parametric scheme, which is written here. And G1, G2, it's what I sort of mentioned before, and which is also, again, written down on the next slide. It's this Stiglov averaging operation.
So is it you're incorporating different degrees of implicitness in each of the cases?
Yes, for each case, basically, generally, it covers all situation possible implicit or explicit schemes, and which is the best I'm going to sort of to mention. The initial boundary conditions, the only sort of care should be taken with respect to the approximation of this boundary condition, but everything else relatively easily could be done. Now, this is just a highlight of the approximation for the nonlinear terms. So what does it give you, as you just, Simon, said, that essentially that three parametric schemes covers all situations, both implicit and explicit schemes. But the point is that these different schemes approximate the differential problem with this order of accuracy, where H is the spatial and co is the temporal discretization, on the minimal possible stencil. And of course, this is one of the motivation why we started doing that, because remember, there is a sort of reasonably straightforward way how you could approach the problem. You use method of line, you reduce the system to differential algebraic system, but the resolution needs to be very high to resolve this phase transition effect. So that's why we were looking sort of for more elaborate mathematical methodologies. So this is the one point. Now, what do we do next? We are trying to sort of to show that that cancellation law that we derived for differential problem also holds for our numerical approximation. And of course, here we sort of need to introduce certain scalar sort of difference analog of these scalar products, after which you could sort of show some lemma, which I don't want necessarily to go into details, but essentially this is a relationship at the discrete level between the velocity and essentially the stress, which corresponds to one of the differential equations. What does it give you? It allows you to proceed. For example, you could multiply the equation of motion by this value, where sigma 1, you may remember, is essentially the splitting between two time layers. If you use the lemma that I just mentioned, it would bring you to the following relationship. In this relationship, everything is sort of reasonably nice, although it may look sort of a little bit complicated. I mean, plus here corresponds to forward difference derivative, minus corresponds to backward difference derivative. And as I said, parameters here corresponds to the splitting between two time layers. So anyway, I mean, the first and the second terms are okay. You have squared here. The only term that you have to take care of is this one. And we could do that as well. So this is the representation of this particular term. Of course, it sort of requires a little bit work. But in the end of the day, what you comes to the following representation. So this, in a sense, this part, first of all, is related to the boundary condition approximations. This part is essentially analog to your energy representation for the differential case. The only pain is this part. This part essentially is written explicitly here. But essentially, this is a disbalanced term that does not allow you formally to preserve the energy at the discrete level. However, so that's essentially the summary of what I said. The scheme would be fully conservative if the energy disbalance, exactly that term, somehow could be made zero. And you could do that, and we actually prove that the necessary conditions for the conservativeness would be simply to choose the appropriate weights here at 0.5, 0.5. Now, there is still one parameter here. And amazingly, what you will have in the end, that if you would like to preserve positiveness of your temperature, this parameter also has to be fixed. So first of all, the result of this, this is sort of the summary, the great analog of the conservation law, where sort of what you see here is basically the analog of the energy that we introduce in differential case. And the summary of this is that essentially you could use the minimal stencil for the construction of your numerical approximation and preserve properties, these conservative properties in the numerical approximation. This is one of the calculations that we made basically for all, for displacements, for strain, for temperature, for stress, and so on. And this is sort of in time, so we could move and reproduce this effect quite nicely. And as I said, it's sort of the minimal stencil. Now, any questions with respect to 1D case?
Sigma 3 equal to half, is that kind of like upwinding for when you want to preserve?
Sigma, actually, it will result in an implicit scheme.
Yeah.
It will result in an implicit scheme, but the scheme will be on the minimal stencil. And this is pretty natural requirement. I mean, if you don't have this, you would not preserve positiveness of the temperature, which is sort of physically required. Now, sort of having success in this one-dimensional case, we ask the question, okay, what can we do for the three-dimensional situations? And this is, of course, much, much more complicated. Situations. One of the reasons is the following. First of all, when we are talking about martensitic phases in the one-dimensional case, we essentially are talking about twin martensites. So eventually you will see also the picture like that, sort of martensitic twins. But if you are talking about three-dimensional situations, the total number of martensitic phases could be 24. So if you're talking about sort of invariant properties and things like that, you have to talk about invariant properties with respect to the symmetry group 48. And this complicates the situation drastically. But, yes?
The 1D problem is set in with a periodic boundary condition?
No, it's not periodic boundary conditions. It's a temporal special region where essentially on the boundary mechanically you define stress. Now, for the three-dimensional case, it may look sort of a little bit complicated because we also enumerated here non-local effects, but I mean, forget about this right-hand side part, which may be complicated. Conceptually, it's simple because you have, again, hyperbolic type equation coupled to parabolic type of equation. Of course, you would have strong non-linearities here, but conceptually it's sort of simple thing. And here, sort of to give you some ideas, this three-dimensional sort of generalization is written down just for 1D case. We accounted for additional effects, for example, like sort of time relaxation, which is sort of tau zero, and we accounted also for the rate of change for the deformation gradient and for temperature. That's where these sort of big terms are coming from. But if you, for a second, forget about relaxation time, which is tau zero, and if you forget about these effects, you will get essentially our one-dimensional model that I considered before. So this, but for 3D case, the starting point, again, free energy function. And what you do, you have to sort of expand or to get the approximation of the free energy function using polynomials approximation, but your coefficient will be temperature dependent. And this is sort of formal sort of mathematical representation or expansion of your free energy function. Now, how these terms look like, you will see just on the next slide. These terms are represented in terms of the strain invariance. This is curl I is the strain invariance, and this is the coefficient, which is temperature-dependent coefficient. You see also here that the summation is up to certain value Jn, and what is Jn is, I already basically already mentioned, because what we want to do, we want to make the energy function invariant with respect to the symmetry group of the parent phase, which is essentially, you know, here, this index is 48. Because, as I said, there are 24 possible Martensitic variants. So you see that it's becoming sort of almost hopeless to solve this problem. Well, we use certain parameterization here, so the total number of parameters was reduced from 32 to 10, but still this free energy function looks like fairly complicated, where, say, I22 is written down in this way, so where these components are essentially strain components in your strain tensor. So it's sort of not very encouraging, because what you have to do, you have to plug in this free energy function in that three-dimensional models and then sort of somehow to solve it.
How did you come up with these strain invariants?
Sorry?
How did you come up with this?
Strain invariance essentially is this symmetry representation. As I mentioned, the original paper, Landau-Ginzburg, accounted just for fourth-order polynomials, which are not sufficient to describe phenomena like that. So Fork, in 1980, made an expansion to six-order polynomial, and together with Kanapka, actually they extended in 1990 this model to the 3D type model where they accounted for all these symmetries. So the specific type of strain invariance were given in their paper. This is, I've just presented for you just one simple example to show that to realize this model it's not easy, although sort of. So how do we deal with this? Well, we deal with this using centimanifold theory. There are a number of reasons why we do that. This is fairly complicated model. So what we want to reduce this model to a low-dimensional model. And one of the reasons is that a centimanifold in situations like this not need to be unique. But what we do, the differences between the possible centimanifolds that we are constructing are of the same order as the differences we set to ignore in establishing the low-dimensional model. The other point is, which is very often is overlooked because centimanifold apply to original equations, but we have to take care also about our initial boundary conditions. The technique is pretty straightforwardly also could be applied to the deriving correct initial and boundary conditions. And what is paramount for the situation like this is that centimanifold technique doesn't need to be linked to just one equilibrium configuration. And for phase transformations, it is very essential. The framework, you sort of, in this audience, well familiar. So what basically we do, parameterized family of the model that we are using, where we split sort of linear and nonlinear parts, and where L is the linear operator and F is at least quadratic here, nonlinear function in both in epsilon and U. There are difficulties here, and difficulties very nicely were formulated in a number of sort of papers by James Robinson from Warwick, I guess, previously here, right? And this is related to spectral gap conditions, which is not very easy to trace down or to verify when you deal with three-dimensional models like I'm dealing with here. The point here that we are trying to put is that traditionally a truncated form of the original model is obtained by using a single parameter such as epsilon in order to scale all other effects. Of course, those of you who sort of deal with multi-scale methodologies know that this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable. This model that I'm describing here covers much more general situation, which is pretty typical for all coupled dynamic problems that you have to deal with. And moreover, you know, I mean, many of you know that representing all effects at leading order of a single small parameter can result in misleading outputs. So what is needed, and this is essentially the essence of what I'm going to do next, what is needed here is a careful balancing of the order of small effects in the model construction, rather than at the stage of the application of this model. The procedure of the center manifold, I mean, this is basically the realization that, again, sort of very slightly deviated from what many of you know quite well. So basically, we link the original dynamic and the low-dimensional dynamic, where nu here is a vector function to be found. And we also look for the function g, here vector function g, which essentially the evolution on this low dimensional manifold. So basically what you have to do, you have to construct g and nu. And you could do that. First, getting started from sort of linear approximation to the center manifold, where say g here is, for example, could be represented in Jordan form, and nu is approximated linearly. But of course it's not sufficient, because this is just the first step in projecting the linear and nonlinear parts of the original dynamics and the slow modes of interest, and you have to modify that by sort of nonlinear terms. So that's sort of shaping manifold, if you like. Basically what you could show easily for this type of problems is the following, that assume that you are the iteration capital J, and you already constructed this vector function g nu and g. So what can be shown is that on the next iteration, by driving residuals to zero, you could show that you could improve this approximation, and you could add certain corrections, which are denoted here as delta nu and delta g, such that you would increase the accuracy of your problem by 1 in both in beta 1 and beta 2, which is sort of highlighted briefly here. What we do, we essentially substitute those corrected values that you've seen on the previous slide, these sort of values with this correction, into the original dynamics, and you essentially can get in iterative manner the order of accuracy which is higher than the original one. And essentially, of course, you have to sort of rely on some iterative procedures which essentially could be easily reduced to the solution of system of linear equations. What is the result of that in the context of these phase transformations that I'm talking about? We can see sort of this is a specific problem, again, based on the original three-dimensional representations, as I've shown you, for the specific parameterization that, again, I highlighted. Remember, I mentioned that we made parameterization and reduced the total number of parameters in the free energy function to 10, and we solved those strain invariants and stuff like that. After application of center manifolds, essentially, you would come to the following model. Now, of course, these coefficients I have not written down here explicitly, but you should not care about them. This is just a constant. What you come to understand after you analyze this model, that this model mathematically, it's pretty similar to the one-dimensional case that I considered already. And therefore, that methodology based on conservative numerical approximations that I showed you before could be applied to the situation like that as well. And that's what we did. Essentially, this is just what I already said, that the results obtained for one-dimensional models are applicable in this case. And what you do, you apply that conservative scheme developed for that situation to this particular case. This is one of the examples of the of the results based on this reduced model that we derive from center manifold technique. And what is also probably, so the my time is coming, to the end. What is also interesting to point out here, I already mentioned to you that, remember, for the one-dimensional case, essentially you are dealing with twin martensite. Twin martensite, if you like, here you could view in this way. Now, you see time here start from T0. You start from originally not this type of configuration. You start with different initial condition. But the system will go to its attractor, which essentially this twin martensite, after going first to austenite phase. Austenite phase is essentially where you see displacements are zeros. To the original sort of configurations of twin martensites. And what else is represented? I mean, here is the temperature and here is strain. So I come to the conclusions, what essentially you've seen here. So what we what you've seen here is conservation of total energy of the original nonlinear differential model for first order phase transformations for the differential case, where we dealt with the quintic order nonlinearities. Then we derived conservative difference scheme for the description of the dynamics associated with these first order phase transformations. Then we derived difference analog of the conservation law for the total energy of the system on the grid. And in this sense, the scheme is superior to all other schemes previously proposed. In the three-dimensional case, we proposed a systematic approach to the numerical solution of these multidimensional evolutionary systems with phase transformations, where methodologies based on the spectral gap conditions may fail. And essentially, what it gives you that even on fairly coarse grids, the scheme is capable of capturing all main features of the dynamics, including hysteresis effects. And that's what you have to do when you would like to deal with the phase transformations. So at this point, I'd like just to thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions or to continue the discussion, I'll be very happy to. Thanks.
Thank you. So, questions, please.
I missed in your center manifold reduction thing how the other dimensions kind of seem to, you know, disappear in some sense. I missed that bit.
Well, they are not disappearing. We simply set up to reduce this general three-dimensional model
to a finite. Small one-dimensional.
Yes, to the one-dimensional model. So this is something that was sort of was the aim of this procedure, to reduce from three-dimensional.
So it's done with respect to the other direction, and you're still left with the one.
Yes. And also the original problem, if you like, sort of mechanics of the problem, it was considered essentially the slab, which helps as well.
And the center manifold exists theoretically, only computationally.
That's the points that I was trying to put. I mean, of course, center manifold is not unique in this situation,
yes.
as I highlighted. But in a computational sense, it doesn't matter, because essentially you preset your accuracy, and all center manifolds that you could construct with predefined accuracy are treated as the same. But I guess the most important advantage here in the context of center manifold with respect to this problem in the multidimensional case is that it's really easy to treat these multi-equilibria situations with center manifold.
And the type of numerical kind of approximation that you've done, I mean, you might have considered many other kinds. You might have considered many other.
You mean for one-dimensional case or
multi-dimensional case? I mean, quite
three.
Finite differences, right?
So. Yes, but I mean, if you look at the system that you get in the after reduction on center manifold, I mean that system mathematically, it's pretty much the same as you had in the classical one-dimensional case. So it's pretty natural to apply you know, again, this conservative scheme to the situation like that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Ernst is doing this sort of a lot of this long time integration. I mean, this is very important topic here as well. We do need to do long time integration here. And certainly, I don't know whether all properties are conserved or not, but I do know that for this particular situation, energy is conserved on the grid, and this is certainly a very nice property. And especially because this conservation is made on the minimal computational stencil. So the minimal number of points for your discretizations is used here. So, but along that line that we originally sort of probably we have had to talk to you well years back, but I mean along that step, I mean it's sort of differential algebraic system, right? I don't know, maybe sort of some other quite effective procedures could be derived based on that original ideas that we sort of just use this stress-strain relationship as algebraic equation and then have differential algebraic system. Although it is a system with quintic nonlinearity. You know.
One alternative might be to use something like RPM,
mm-hmm.
recursive projection method.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, in the long term, to perform the Schmidt-Lipschitz decomposition and throw away the all the unstable junk.
But wouldn't you do similar when you do this center manifold reduction, essentially?
I think that they're linked.
They're linked.
RPM sort of is technically quite well designed, especially in symmetric cases.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. If there are no further questions, thank you again.
Thanks.